up tools, suffered hunting accidents, and she always felt the pain and the waste of a lost hand, a crushed leg, a damaged brain. To see men inflicting such wounds on one another intentionally revolted her. For a long time it seemed the fight could go either way. If she had been at home, hearing news of the war from afar, she might have hoped for an English victory. But after what she had seen in the last 2 weeks, she felt a sort of disgusted neutrality. She could not identify with the English who had murdered peasants and burned their crops, and it made no difference to her that they had committed these atrocities in Normandy. Of course, they would say the French deserved what they got because they had burned Portsmouth, but that was a stupid way to think, so stupid that it led to scenes of horror such as this. The French retreated, and she assumed they would regroup and reorganize, and wait for the king to arrive to develop a new battle plan. They still had overwhelming superiority in numbers, she could see. There were tens of thousands of troops in the valley, with more still arriving. But the French did not regroup. Instead, every new battalion that arrived went straight into the attack, throwing themselves suicidally up the hill at the English position. The second and subsequent charges fared worse than the first. Some were cut down by archers even before they reached the English lines. The rest were beaten off by foot soldiers. The slope below the ridge became shiny with the gushing blood of hundreds of men and horses. After the first charge, Caris looked only occasionally at the battle. She was too busy tending those French wounded who were lucky enough to be able to leave the field. Martin Chirurgien had realized that she was as good a surgeon as he. Giving her free access to his instruments, he left her and Mare to work independently. They washed, sewed, and bandaged hour after hour. News of prominent casualties came back to them from the front line. Charles of Alençon was the first high-ranking fatality. Caris could not help feeling that he deserved his fate. She had witnessed his foolish enthusiasm and careless indiscipline. Hours later, King Jean of Bohemia was reported dead, and she wondered what madness drove a blind man to battle. "In God's name, why don't they stop?" she said to Martin, when he brought her a cup of ale to refresh her. "Fear," he replied. "They are scared of disgrace. To leave the field without striking a blow would be shameful. They would prefer to die." "A lot of them have had that wish granted," said Caris grimly, and she emptied her tankard and went back to work. Her knowledge and understanding of the human body was growing by leaps and bounds, she reflected. She saw inside every part of a living man, the brains beneath shattered skulls, the pipework of the throat, the muscles of the arms sliced open, the heart and lungs within smashed rib cages, the slimy tangle of the intestines, the articulation of the bones at hip and knee and ankle. She discovered more in an hour on the battlefield than in a year at the Priory Hospital. This was how Matthew Barber had learned so much, she realized. No wonder he was confident. The carnage continued until night fell. The English lit torches, afraid of a sneak attack under cover of darkness. But Caris could have told them they were safe. The French were routed. She could hear the calls of French soldiers searching the battlefield for fallen kinsmen and comrades. The king, who had arrived in time to join one of the last hopeless charges, left the field. After that, the exit became general. A fog came up from the river, filling the valley and obscuring the distant flares. Once again, Caris and Mare worked by firelight long into the night, patching up the wounded. All those who could walk or hobble left as soon as they could, putting as much distance as possible between themselves and the English, hoping to avoid tomorrow's inevitable bloodthirsty mopping-up operation. When Caris and Mare had done all they could for the victims, they slipped away. This was their chance. They located their ponies and led them forward by the light of a burning torch. They reached the bottom of the valley and found themselves in no man's land. Hidden by fog and darkness, they slipped out of their boys' clothing. For a moment, they were terribly vulnerable, two naked women in the middle of a battlefield. But no one could see them, and a second later they were pulling their nuns' robes over their heads. They packed up their male garments in case they should need them again. It was a long way home. Caris decided to abandon the torch, in case an English archer should take it into his head to shoot at the light and ask questions afterwards. Holding hands so that they would not get separated, they went forward, still leading the horses. They could see nothing. The fog obscured whatever light might have come from moon or stars. They headed uphill towards the English lines. There was a smell like a butcher's shop. So many bodies of horses and men covered the ground that they could not walk around them. They had to grit their teeth and step on the corpses. Soon their shoes were covered with a mixture of mud and blood. The bodies on the ground thinned out, and soon there were none. Caris began to feel a deep sense of relief as she approached the English army. She and Mare had travelled hundreds of miles, lived rough for 2 weeks, and risked their lives for this moment. She had almost forgotten the outrageous theft by Prior Godwin of £150 from the nun's treasury, the reason for her journey. Somehow it seemed less important after all this bloodshed. Still, she would appeal to Bishop Richard and win justice for the nunnery. The walk seemed farther than Caris had imagined when she had looked across the valley in daylight. She wondered nervously if she had become disoriented. She might have turned in the wrong direction and just walked straight past the English. Perhaps the army was now behind her. She strained to hear some noise. 10,000 men could not be silent, even if most of them had fallen into exhausted sleep. But the fog muffled sound. She clung to the conviction that, as King Edward had positioned his forces on the highest land, she must be approaching him as long as she was walking uphill. But the blindness was unnerving. If there had been a precipice, she would have stepped right over it. The light of dawn was turning the fog to the color of pearl when at last she heard a voice. She stopped. It was a man speaking in a low murmur. Mare squeezed her hand nervously. Another man spoke. She could not make out the language. She feared that she might have walked in a full circle and arrived back on the French side. She turned towards the voice, still holding Mare's hand. The red glow of flames became visible through the grey mist, and she headed for it gratefully. As she came nearer, she heard their talk more clearly, and realized with immense relief that they were speaking English. A moment later, she made out a group of men around a fire. Several lay asleep, rolled in blankets, but three sat upright, legs crossed, looking into the flames, talking. A moment later, Caris saw a man standing, peering into the fog, presumably on sentry duty, though the fact that he had not noticed her approach proved his job was impossible. To get their attention, Caris said in a low voice, "God bless you, men of England." She startled them. One gave a shout of fear. The sentry said belatedly, "Who goes there?" "Two nuns from Kingsbridge Priory," Caris said. The men stared at her in superstitious dread, and she realized they thought she might be an apparition. "Don't worry. We're flesh and blood, and so are these ponies."
"Did you say Kingsbridge?" said one of them in surprise. "I know you," he said, standing up. "I've seen you before."
Caris recognized him. "Lord William of Castor," she said. "I am the Earl of Shiring now," he said. "My father died of his wounds an hour ago. May his soul rest in peace. We have come here to see your brother, Bishop Richard, who is our abbot." "You're too late," William said. "My brother, too, is dead." Later in the morning, when the fog had lifted and the battlefield looked like a sunlit slaughterhouse, Earl William took Caris and Mare to see King Edward. Everyone was astonished at the tale of the two nuns who had followed the English army all through Normandy, and soldiers who had faced death only yesterday were fascinated by their adventures. William told Caris that the king would want to hear the story from her own lips. Edward III had been king for 19 years, but he was still only 33 years old. Tall and broad-shouldered, he was imposing rather than handsome, with a face that might have been moulded for power, a big nose, high cheekbones, and luxuriant long hair just beginning to recede from his high forehead. Caris saw why people called him a lion. He sat on a stool in front of his tent, fashionably dressed in two-coloured hose and a cape with a scalloped border. He wore no armour or weapons. The French had vanished, and in fact a force of vengeful troops had been sent out to hunt down and kill any stragglers. A handful of barons stood around. As Caris told how she and Mare had sought food and shelter in the devastated landscape of Normandy, she wondered if the king felt criticized by her tale of hardship. However, he seemed not to think the sufferings of the people reflected on him. He was as delighted with her exploits as if he were hearing of someone who had been brave during a shipwreck. She ended by telling him of her disappointment on finding, after all her travails, that Bishop Richard, from whom she hoped for justice, was dead. "I beg your majesty to order the prior of Kingsbridge to restore to the nuns the money he stole." Edward smiled ruefully. "You're a brave woman, but you know nothing of politics," he said with condescension. "The king can't get involved in an ecclesiastical quarrel such as this. We would have all our bishops banging on our door in protest." That might be so, Caris reflected, but it did not prevent the king interfering with the church when it suited his own purposes. However, she said nothing. Edward went on, "And it would do your cause harm. The church would be so outraged that every cleric in the land would oppose our ruling, regardless of its merits." There might be something in that, she judged, but he was not as powerless as he pretended. "I know you will remember the wronged nuns of Kingsbridge," she said. "When you appoint the new bishop of Kingsbridge, please tell him our story." "Of course," said the king, but Caris had the feeling he would forget. The interview seemed to be over, but then William said, "Your Majesty, now that you have graciously confirmed my elevation to my father's earldom, there is the question of who is to be Lord of Castor." "Ah, yes. Our son, the Prince of Wales, suggests Sir Ralph Fitzgerald, who was knighted yesterday for saving his life." Caris murmured, "Oh, no." The king did not hear her, but William did, and he obviously felt the same way. He was not quite able to hide his indignation as he said, "Ralph was an outlaw, guilty of numerous thefts, murders, and rapes, until he obtained a royal pardon by joining your majesty's army." The king was not as moved by this as Caris expected. He said, "All the same, Ralph has fought with us for 7 years now. He has earned a second chance." "Indeed, he has," William said diplomatically, "but given the trouble we've had with him in the past, I'd like to see him settle down peacefully for a year or two before he's ennobled." "Well, you will be his overlord, so you'll have to deal with him," Edward granted. "We won't impose him on you against your will. However, the prince is keen that he should have some further reward." The king thought for a few moments, then said, "Don't you have a cousin who is eligible for marriage?" "Yes, Matilda," said William. "We call her Tilly." Caris knew Tilly. She was at the nunnery school. "That's right," said Edward. "She was your father Roland's ward. Her father had 3 villages near Shiring. Your Majesty has a good memory for detail. Marry Lady Matilda to Ralph, and give him her father's villages," said the king. Caris was appalled. "But she's only 12, she burst out. William said to her, "Hush!" King Edward turned a cold gaze on her. "The children of the nobility must grow up fast, sister. Queen Philippa was 14 when I married her." Caris knew she should shut up, but she could not. Tilly was only 4 years older than the daughter she might have had if she had given birth to Merthyn's baby. "There's a big difference between 12 and 14,
she said desperately. The young king became even more frosty. In the royal presence, people give their opinions only when asked, and the king almost never asks for the opinions of women. Caris realized she had taken the wrong tack. Her objection to the marriage was not based on Tilly's age so much as Ralph's character. "I know, Tilly," she said. "You can't marry her to that brute, Ralph." Mayor said in a scared whisper, "Caris, remember who you're speaking to?" Edward looked at William. "Take her away, Shiring, before she says something that cannot be overlooked." William took Caris's arm and firmly marched her out of the royal presence. Mayor followed. Behind them, Caris heard the king say, "I can see how she survived in Normandy. The locals must have been terrified of her." The noblemen around him laughed. "You must be mad," William hissed. "Must I?" Caris said. They were out of earshot of the king now, and she raised her voice. "In the last 6 weeks, the king has caused the deaths of thousands of men, women, and children, and burned their crops and their homes. And I have tried to save a 12-year-old girl from being married to a murderer. Tell me again, Lord William, which of us is mad?" Chapter 51. In the year 1347, the peasants of Wigley suffered a poor harvest. The villagers did what they always did in such times. They ate less food, postponed the purchase of hats and belts, and slept closer together for warmth. Old Widow Hubert died earlier than expected. Janie Jones succumbed to a cough that she might have survived in a good year, and Joanna David's new baby, who might otherwise have had a chance, failed to make it to his first birthday. Gwenda kept an anxious eye on her two little boys. Sam, the 8-year-old, was big for his age and strong. He had Wulfric's physique, people said, though Gwenda knew that, in truth, he was like his real father, Ralph Fitzgerald. Even so, Sam was visibly thinner by December. David, named after Wulfric's brother who had died when the bridge collapsed, was 6. He resembled Gwenda, being small and dark. The poor diet had weakened him, and all through the autumn he suffered minor ailments. A cold, then a skin rash, then a cough. All the same, she took the boys with her when she went with Wulfric to finish sowing the winter wheat on Perkin's land. A bitterly cold wind swept across the open fields. She dropped seeds into the furrows, and Sam and David chased off the daring birds who tried to snatch the seeds before Wulfric turned the earth over. As they ran and jumped and shouted, Gwenda marveled that these two fully functioning miniature human beings had come from inside her body. They turned the chasing of the birds into some kind of competitive game, and she delighted in the miracle of their imagination. Once part of her, they were now able to have thoughts she did not know about. Mud clung to their feet as they tramped up and down. A fast-running stream bordered the big field, and on the far bank stood the fulling mill Merthin had built 9 years ago. The distant rumble of its pounding wooden hammers accompanied their work. The mill was run by 2 eccentric brothers, Jack and Eli, both unmarried men with no land, and an apprentice boy who was their nephew. They were the only villagers who had not suffered on account of the bad harvest. Mark Webber paid them the same wages all winter long. It was a short midwinter day. Gwenda and her family finished sowing just as the grey sky began to darken, and the twilight gathered mistily in the distant woods. They were all tired. There was half a sack of seed left over, so they took it to Perkin's house. As they approached the place, they saw Perkin himself coming from the opposite direction. He was walking beside a cart on which his daughter Annet was riding. They had been to Kingsbridge to sell the last of the year's apples and pears from Perkin's trees. Annet still retained her girlish figure, although she was now 28 and had had a child. She called attention to her youthfulness with a dress that was a little too short and a hairstyle that was charmingly disarrayed. She looked silly, Gwenda thought. Her opinion was shared by every woman in the village,
and none of the men. Gwenda was shocked to see that Perkins' cart was full of fruit. "What happened?" she said. Perkins' face was grim. "Kingsbridge folk are having a hard winter just like us," he said. "They've no money to buy apples. We shall have to make cider with this lot." That was bad news. Gwenda had never known Perkin to come home from the market with so much unsold produce. Annette seemed unworried. She held out a hand to Wulfric, who helped her down from the cart. As she stepped to the ground, she stumbled and fell against him with her hand on his chest. "Oops," she said, and smiled at him as she recovered her balance. Wulfric flushed with pleasure. "You blind idiot," Gwenda thought. They went inside. Perkin sat at the table, and his wife, Peggy, brought him a bowl of pottage. He cut a thick slice from the loaf on the board. Peggy served her own family next. Annette, her husband, Billy Howard, Annette's brother, Rob, and Rob's wife. She gave a little to Annette's 4-year-old daughter, Angela, and to Rob's 2 small boys. Then she invited Wulfric and his family to sit down. Gwenda spooned up the broth hungrily. It was thicker than the pottage she made. Peggy was putting stale bread in, whereas in Gwenda's house the bread never lasted long enough to go stale. Perkins' family got cups of ale, but Gwenda and Wulfric were not offered any. Hospitality went only so far in hard times. Perkin was jocular with his customers, but otherwise a sourpuss, and the atmosphere in his house was always more or less dismal. He talked in a disheartened way about the Kingsbridge market. Most of the traders had had a bad day. The only ones doing any business were those who sold essentials, such as corn, meat, and salt. No one was buying the now famous Kingsbridge scarlet cloth. Peggy lit a lamp. Gwenda wanted to go home, but she and Wulfric were waiting for their wages. The boys began to misbehave, running around the room and bumping into adults. "It's getting near their bedtime," said Gwenda, though it was not really. At last Wulfric said, "If you'll give us our wages, Perkin, we'll leave." "I haven't got any money," Perkin said. Gwenda stared at him. He had never said anything like this in the 9 years she and Wulfric had been working for him. Wulfric said, "We must have our wages. We've got to eat." "You've had some pottage, haven't you?" Perkin said. Gwenda was outraged. "We work for money, not pottage." "Well, I haven't got any money," Perkin repeated. "I went to market to sell my apples, but no one bought them, so I've got more apples than we can eat and no money." Gwenda was so shocked that she did not know what to say. It had never occurred to her that Perkin might not pay them. She felt a stab of fear as she realized there was nothing she could do about it. Wulfric said slowly, "Well, what's to be done about it? Shall we go to the long field and take the seeds back out of the ground?" "I'll have to owe you this week's wages," Perkin said. "I'll pay you when things get better." "And next week?" "I won't have any money next week either. Where do you think it's to come from?" Gwenda said, "We'll go to Mark Weaver. Perhaps he can employ us at the fulling mill." Perkin shook his head. "I spoke to him yesterday in Kingsbridge and asked if he could hire you. He said no, he's not selling enough cloth. He'll continue to employ Jack and Eli and the boy and stockpile the cloth until trade picks up, but he can't take on any extra hands." Wulfric was bewildered. "How are we to live? How will you get your spring ploughing done?" "You can work for food," Perkin offered. Wulfric looked at Gwenda. She choked back a scornful retort. She and her family were in deep trouble, and this was not the moment to antagonize anyone. She thought fast. They did not have much choice. Eat or starve. "We'll work for food, and you'll owe us the money," she said. Perkin shook his head. "What you're suggesting may be fair." "It is fair." "All right, it is fair. But just the same, I can't do it. I don't know when I'll have the money." "Why, I could owe you a pound, come Whitson. You can work for food, or not at all. You'll have to feed all four of us.
Yes, but only Wulfric will work.
I don't know. A family wants more than food.
Children need clothes. A man must have boots. If you can't pay me, I will have to find some other way of providing such things.
How?
I don't know. She paused. The truth was, she had no idea. She fought down panic. I may have to ask my father how he manages.
Peggy put in, I wouldn't do that if I were you. Joby will tell you to steal.
Gwenda was stung. What right did Peggy have to take a supercilious attitude? Joby had never employed people, then told them at the end of the week that he could not pay them.
But she bit her tongue and said mildly, He fed me through 18 winters, even if he did sell me to outlaws at the end.
Peggy tossed her head and abruptly began to pick up the bowls from the table.
Wulfric said, We should go.
Gwenda did not move. Whatever advantages she could gain had to be won now. When she left this house, Perkin would consider that a bargain had been struck and could not be renegotiated. She thought hard. Remembering how Peggy had given ale only to her own family, she said, You won't fob us off with stale fish and watery beer. You'll feed us exactly the same as yourself and your family. Meat, bread, ale, whatever it may be.
Peggy made a deprecating noise. She had been planning to do just what Gwenda feared, it seemed.
Gwenda added, That is, if you want Wulfric to do the same work as you and Rob. They all knew perfectly well that Wulfric did more work than Rob and twice as much as Perkin.
All right, Perkin said.
And this is strictly an emergency arrangement. As soon as you get money, you have to start paying us again at the old rate, a penny a day each.
Yes.
There was a short silence. Wulfric said, Is that it?
I think so, Gwenda said.
You and Perkin should shake hands on the bargain.
They shook hands.
Taking their children, Gwenda and Wulfric left. It was now full dark. Clouds hid the stars, and they had to make their way by the glimmer of light, shining through cracks in shutters and around doors. Fortunately, they had walked from Perkin's house to their own 1,000 times before. Wulfric lit a lamp and built up the fire while Gwenda put the boys to bed. Although there were bedrooms upstairs, they were still living in the large house that had been occupied by Wulfric's parents. Nevertheless, they all slept in the kitchen for warmth. Gwenda felt depressed as she wrapped the boys in blankets and settled them near the fire. She had grown up, determined not to live the way her mother did, in constant worry and want. She had aspired to independence, a patch of land, a hard-working husband, a reasonable lord. Wulfric yearned to get back the land his father had farmed. In all those aspirations they had failed. She was a pauper, and her husband a landless laborer, whose employer could not even pay him a penny a day. She had ended up exactly like her mother, she thought, and she felt too bitter for tears. Wulfric took a pottery bottle from a shelf and poured ale into a wooden cup.
Enjoy it. Gwenda said sourly, You won't be able to buy your own ale for a while.
Wulfric said conversationally, It's amazing that Perkin has no money. He's the richest man in the village, apart from Nathan Reeve.
Perkin has money, Gwenda said. There's a jar of silver pennies under his fireplace. I've seen it.
Then why won't he pay us?
He doesn't want to dip into his savings.
Wulfric was taken aback.
But he could pay us if he wanted to.
Of course.
Then why am I going to work for food?
Gwenda let out an impatient grunt. Wulfric was so slow on the uptake.
Because the alternative was no work at all.
Wulfric was feeling that they had been hoodwinked.
We should have insisted on payment.
Then why didn't you?
I didn't know about the jar of pennies under the fireplace.
For God's sake, do you think a man as rich as Perkin can be impoverished by failing to sell one cartload of apples? He's been the largest landholder in Wigley ever since he got hold of your father's acres 10 years ago. Of course he has savings.
Yes, I see that. She stared into the fire while he finished the ale. Then they went to bed. He put his arms around her, and she rested her head on his chest. But she did not want to make love. She was too angry. She told herself she should not take it out on her husband. Perkin had let them down, not Wulfric. But she was angry with Wulfric. Furious. As she sensed him drifting off to sleep, she realized that her anger was not about their wages. That was the kind of misfortune that afflicted everyone from time to time, like bad weather and barley mold. What, then? She recalled the way Annet had fallen against Wulfric as she stepped down from the cart. When she remembered Annet's coquettish smile and Wulfric's flush of pleasure, she wanted to slap his face. "I'm angry with you," she thought, "because that worthless, empty-headed flirt can still make you look such a damn fool." On the Sunday before Christmas, a manor court was held in the church after the service. It was cold, and the villagers huddled together, wrapped in cloaks and blankets. Nathan Reeve was in charge. The lord of the manor, Ralph Fitzgerald, had not been seen in Wigley for years. So much the better, Gwenda thought. Besides, he was Sir Ralph now, with 3 other villages in his fiefdom, so he would not take much interest in ox teams and cow pasture. Alfred Shorthouse had died during the week. He was a childless widower with 10 acres.
"He has no natural heirs," said Nate Reeve. "Perkin is willing to take over his land."
Gwenda was surprised. How could Perkin think of taking on more land? She was too startled to respond immediately, and Aaron Appletree, the bagpipe player, spoke first.
"Alfred has been in poor health since the summer," he said. "He's done no autumn ploughing and sown no winter wheat. All the work is to be done. Perkin will have his hands full."
Nate said aggressively,
"Are you asking for the land yourself?"
Aaron shook his head.
"In a few more years, when my boys are big enough to help with the work, I'll jump at such a chance," he said. "I couldn't handle it now."
"I can manage it," Perkin said.
Gwenda frowned. Nate obviously wanted Perkin to have the land. No doubt a bribe had been promised. She had known all along that Perkin had money, but she had little interest in exposing Perkin's duplicity. She was thinking of how she could exploit this situation to her advantage and get her family out of poverty.
Nate said, "You could take on another labourer, Perkin."
"Wait a minute," Gwenda said. "Perkin can't pay the labourers he's got now. How can he take on more land?"
Perkin was taken aback, but he could hardly deny what Gwenda was saying, so he remained silent.
Nate said, "Well, who else can cope with it?"
Gwenda said quickly, "We'll take it." Nate looked surprised. She added quickly, "Wulfric is working for food. I have no work. We need land." She noticed several nodding heads. No one in the village liked what Perkin had done. They all feared that one day they might end up in the same situation. Nate saw the danger of his plan going awry.
"You can't afford the entry fee," he said.
"We'll pay it a little at a time."
Nate shook his head.
"I want a tenant who can pay right away."
He looked around the assembled villagers. However, no one volunteered.
"David Johns?"
David was a middle-aged man whose sons had land of their own.
"I would have said yes a year ago," he said, "but the rain at harvest time knocked me back."
The offer of an extra 10 acres would normally have had the more ambitious villagers fighting among themselves, but it was a bad year. Gwenda and Wulfric were different. For one thing, Wulfric had never ceased to long for land of his own. Alfred's acres were not Wulfric's birthright, but they were better than nothing. Anyway, Gwenda and Wulfric were desperate. Aaron Appletree said,
"Give it to Wulfric, Nate. He's a hard worker. He'll get the ploughing done in time. And he and his wife deserve some good luck. They've had more than their fair share of bad."
Nate looked bad-tempered, but there was a loud rumble of assent from the peasants. Wulfric and Gwenda were well respected, despite their poverty. This was a rare combination of circumstances that could get Gwenda and her family started on the road to a better life, and she felt growing excitement as it began to seem possible. But Nate was still looking dubious. "Sir Ralph hates Wulfric," he said. Wulfric's hand went to his cheek, and he touched the scar made by Ralph's sword. "I know," said Gwenda, "but Ralph's not here." Chapter 52. When Earl Roland died the day after the Battle of Crecy, several people moved a step up the ladder. His elder son William became the Earl, overlord of the county of Shiring, answerable to the king. A cousin of William's, Sir Edward Courthose, became Lord of Castor, took over the rule of the 40 villages of that fiefdom as a sub-tenant of the Earl, and moved into William and Philippa's old house in Castorham, and Sir Ralph Fitzgerald became Lord of Tench. For the next 18 months, none of them went home. They were all too busy travelling with the king and killing French people. Then, in 1347, the war reached a stalemate. The English captured and held the valuable port city of Calais, but otherwise there was little to show for a decade of war, except, of course, a great deal of booty. In January 1348, Ralph took possession of his new property. Tench was a large village with 100 peasant families, and the manor included 2 smaller villages nearby. He also retained Wigley, which was half a day's ride away. Ralph felt a thrill of pride as he rode through Tench. He had looked forward to this moment. The serfs bowed and their children stared. He was lord of every person and owner of every object in the place. The house was set in a compound. Riding in, followed by a cart loaded with French loot, Ralph saw immediately that the defensive walls had long ago fallen into disrepair. He wondered whether he should restore them. The burghers of Normandy had neglected their defences by and large, and that had made it relatively easy for Edward III to overrun them. On the other hand, the likelihood of an invasion of southern England was now very small. Early in the war, most of the French fleet had been wiped out at the port of Sluys, and thereafter the English had controlled the sea channel that separated the two countries. Apart from minor raids by freelance pirates, every battle since Sluys had been fought on French soil. On balance, it hardly seemed worthwhile to rebuild the compound walls. Several grooms appeared and took the horses. Ralph left Alan Fernhill to supervise the unloading and walked towards his new house. He was limping. His injured leg always hurt after a long ride. Tench Hall was a stone-built manor house. It was impressive, he noted with satisfaction, though it needed repairs, not surprisingly, for it had remained unoccupied since Lady Matilda's father died. However, it was modern in design. In old-fashioned houses, the lord's private chamber was an afterthought, stuck on to the end of the all-important great hall. But Ralph could see from the outside that here the domestic apartments took up half the building. He entered the hall, and was annoyed to find Earl William there. At the far end of the room was a large chair made of dark wood, elaborately carved with powerful symbols, angels and lions on the back and arms, snakes and monsters on the legs. It was obviously the chair of the Lord of the Manor, but William was sitting in it. Much of Ralph's pleasure evaporated. He could not enjoy his mastery of the new manor under the scrutiny of his own overlord. It would be like going to bed with a woman while her husband listened outside the door. He masked his displeasure and formally greeted Earl William. The Earl introduced the man standing next to him. "This is Daniel, who has been bailiff here for 20 years, and has taken good care of the place on my father's behalf during Tilly's minority." Ralph acknowledged the bailiff stiffly. William's message was clear. He wanted Ralph to let Daniel continue in the job. But Daniel had been Earl Roland's man, and now he would be Earl William's. Ralph had no intention of letting his domain be managed by the Earl's man. His bailiff would be loyal to him alone. William waited expectantly for Ralph to say something about Daniel. However, Ralph was not going to have that discussion. 10 years ago he would have jumped feet first into an argument, but he had learned a lot in the time he had spent with the king. He was not obliged to get his earl's approval for his choice of bailiff, so he would not seek it. He would say nothing until William had gone, then he would tell Daniel he was assigned to other duties. Both William and Ralph remained stubbornly silent for a few moments. Then the deadlock was broken. A large door opened at the domestic end of the hall, and the tall, elegant figure of Lady Philippa came in. It was many years since Ralph had seen her, but his youthful passion returned with a shock that felt like a punch, leaving him breathless. She was older. She had to be 40, he guessed, but she was in her prime. Perhaps she was a little heavier than he remembered, her hips more rounded, her breasts fuller, but that only added to her allure. She still walked like a queen. As always, the sight of her made him ask resentfully why he could not have a wife like that. In the past, she had barely deigned to notice his presence, but today she smiled and shook his hand and said, "Are you getting to know Daniel?" She, too, wanted him to continue to employ the Earl's retainer. That was why she was being courteous. All the more reason to get rid of the man, he thought with secret relish. "I've just arrived," he said non-committally. Philippa explained their presence. "We wanted to be here when you met young Tilly. She's part of our family." Ralph had commanded the nuns of Kingsbridge Priory to bring his fiancée here to meet him today. Interfering busybodies, the nuns had obviously told Earl William what was happening. Lady Matilda was the ward of Earl Roland, rest his soul, Ralph said, emphasizing that the wardship had ended with Roland's death. "Yes, and I would have expected the king to transfer her wardship to my husband as Roland's heir." Clearly Philippa would have preferred that. "But he did not," Ralph said. "He gave her to me to wed." Although no ceremony had yet taken place, the girl had immediately become Ralph's responsibility. Strictly speaking, William and Philippa had no business to invite themselves here today, as if playing the role of Tilly's parents. But William was Ralph's overlord, so he could visit whenever he pleased. Ralph did not want to quarrel with William. It was too easy for William to make Ralph's life difficult. On the other hand, the new Earl was overreaching his authority here, probably under pressure from his wife. But Ralph was not going to be bullied. The last 7 years had given him the confidence to defend such independence as he was entitled to. Anyway, he was enjoying crossing swords with Philippa. It gave him an excuse to stare at her. He rested his gaze on the assertive line of her jaw and the fullness of her lips. Despite her hauteur, she was forced to engage with him. This was the longest conversation he had ever had with her. "Tilly is very young," said Philippa. "She will be 14 this year," Ralph said. "That's the age our queen was when she married our king, as the king himself pointed out, to me and to Earl William, after the Battle of Crecy. The aftermath of a battle is not necessarily the best moment to decide the fate of a young girl," Philippa said in a lowered voice. Ralph was not going to let that pass. "Speaking for myself, I feel obliged to comply with the decisions of His Majesty." "As do we all," she muttered. Ralph felt he had vanquished her. It was a sexual feeling, almost as if he had lain with her. Satisfied, he turned to Daniel. "My wife-to-be should arrive in time for dinner," he said. "Make sure we have a feast." Philippa said, "I have already seen to that." Ralph slowly turned his head until his eyes were on her again. She had overstepped the bounds of courtesy by going into his kitchen and giving orders. She knew it and reddened. "I didn't know what time you would get here," she said. Ralph said nothing. She would not apologize, but he was content in having forced her to explain herself, a climb down for a woman as proud as she. For a short while there had been the noise of horses outside, and now Ralph's parents came in. He had not seen them for some years, and he hurried to embrace them. They were both in their 50s, but his mother had aged faster, it seemed to him. Her hair was white, and her face was lined. She had the slight stoop of elderly women. His father seemed more vigorous. It was partly the excitement of the moment. He was flushed with pride, and shook Ralph's hand as if pumping water from a well. But there was no grey in his red beard, and his slim figure still appeared spry. They were both wearing new clothes. Ralph had sent the money. Sir Gerald had a heavy wool surcoat, and Lady Maud a fur cloak. Ralph snapped his fingers at Daniel. "Bring wine," he said. For an instant, the bailiff looked as though he might protest at being treated like a maid servant. Then he swallowed his pride and hurried off to the kitchen. Ralph said, "Earl William, Lady Philippa, may I present my father, Sir Gerald, and my mother, Lady Maud." He was afraid that William and Philippa would look down their noses at his parents, but they acknowledged them courteously enough. Gerald said to William, "I was a comrade in arms of your father, may he rest in peace. In fact, Earl William, I knew you as a boy, though you won't remember me." Ralph wished his father would not call attention to his glorious past. It only emphasized how far he had fallen. But William seemed not to notice.
"Well, do you know, I think I do remember," he said.
He was probably just being kind, but Gerald was pleased.
"Of course," William added, "I recall you as a giant at least 7 feet tall."
Gerald, who was short in stature, laughed delightedly. Maud looked around and said,
"My, this is a fine house, Ralph."
"I wanted to decorate it with all the treasures I've brought back from France," he said, "but I've only just got here."
A kitchen girl brought a jug of wine and goblets on a tray, and they all took some refreshment. The wine was good Bordeaux, Ralph noticed, clear and sweet. Due credit to Daniel for keeping the house well supplied, he thought at first. Then he reflected that for many years no one had been here to drink it, except, of course, Daniel. He said to his mother, "Any news of my brother Merthin?"
"He's doing very well," she said proudly, "married with a daughter, and rich. He's building a palace for the family of Buonaventura Caroli."
"But they haven't made him a conte yet, I suppose."
Ralph pretended to be joking, but he was pointing out that Merthin, for all his success, had not gained a noble title, and that it was he, Ralph, who had fulfilled their father's hopes by taking the family back into the nobility.
"Not yet," said his father gaily, as if it were a real possibility that Merthin might become an Italian count, which annoyed Ralph, but only momentarily.
His mother said, "Could we see our rooms?" Ralph hesitated. What did she mean by our rooms? The dreadful thought crossed his mind that his parents might think they were going to live here. He could not have that. They would be a constant reminder of the family's years of shame. Besides, they would cramp his style. On the other hand, he now realized, it was also shameful for a nobleman to let his parents live in a one-room house as pensioners of a priory. He would have to think more about that. For now, he said, "I haven't had a chance to look at the private quarters myself yet. I hope I can make you comfortable for a few nights."
"A few nights?" his mother said quickly. "Are you going to send us back to our hovel in Kingsbridge?"
Ralph was mortified that she should mention that in front of William and Philippa.
"I don't think there's room for you to live here."
"How do you know if you haven't yet looked at the chambers?"
Daniel interrupted. "There's a villager here from Wigley, Sir Ralph, name of Perkin, wants to pay his respects and discuss an urgent matter." Ralph would normally have told the man off for butting into a conversation, but on this occasion he was grateful for the diversion.
"Have a look at the rooms, Mother," he said. "I'll deal with this peasant."
William and Philippa went off with his parents to inspect the domestic quarters, and Daniel brought Perkin to the table. Perkin was as obsequious as ever.
"So happy to see your lordship safe and whole after the French wars," he said.
Ralph looked at his left hand, with three fingers missing.
"Well, almost whole," he said. "All the people of Wagley are sorry for your wounds, lord, but the rewards! A knighthood, and three more villages, and Lady Matilda to wed.
Thank you for your felicitations, but what was the urgent matter you needed to discuss?"
"Lord, it doesn't take long to tell.
Alfred Shorthouse died without a natural heir to his 10 acres, and I offered to take on the land, even though times have been very hard, after this year's thunderstorms in August.
Never mind the weather,
of course. In brief, Nathan Reeve made a decision that I feel you would not approve." Ralph felt impatient. He really did not care which peasant farmed Alfred's 10 acres. Whatever Nathan decided, he gave the land to Wulfric.
"Ah!
Some of the villagers said Wulfric deserved it, as he had no land. But he can't pay the entry fee, and anyway, you don't need to convince me," Ralph said. "I will not allow that troublemaker to hold land in my territory."
"Thank you, lord.
Shall I tell Nathan Reeve that you wish me to have the 10 acres?
"Yes," Ralph said.
He saw the Earl and Countess emerge from the private quarters, with his parents in tow. "I'll be there to confirm it in person within the next 2 weeks." He dismissed Perkin with a wave. At that moment, Lady Matilda arrived. She entered the hall with a nun on either side of her. One was Merthyn's old girlfriend, Caris, who had tried to tell the king that Tilly was too young to marry. On the other side was the nun who had travelled to Crecy with Caris, an angel-faced woman whose name Ralph did not know. Behind them, presumably acting as their bodyguard, was the one-armed monk who had captured Ralph so cleverly 9 years ago, Brother Thomas. And in the centre was Tilly. Ralph saw immediately why the nuns wanted to protect her from marriage. Her face had a look of childish innocence. She had freckles on her nose, and a gap between her two front teeth. She stared about her with frightened eyes. Caris had heightened the childish look by dressing her in a plain white nun's robe and a simple cap, but the clothing failed to hide the womanly curves of the body underneath. Caris had obviously wanted to make Tilly seem too young for wedlock. The effect on Ralph was the opposite of what was intended. One of the things Ralph had learned in the king's service was that, in many situations, a man could take charge simply by speaking first. He said loudly, "Come here, Tilly." The girl stepped forward and came to him. Her escort hesitated, then stayed where they were. "I am your husband," Ralph said to her. "My name is Sir Ralph Fitzgerald, Lord of Tench." She looked terrified.
"I'm happy to meet you, sir."
"This is your home now, as it was when you were a child, and your father was lord here. You are now the Lady of Tench, as your mother once was. Are you happy to be back in your family home?"
"Yes, lord."
She looked anything but happy. "I'm sure the nuns have told you that you must be an obedient wife, and do all you can to please your husband, who is your lord and master."
"Yes, lord."
"And here are my mother and father, who are your parents, too, now." She made a little curtsy to Gerald and Maud. Ralph said, "Come here." He held out his hands. Automatically, Tilly reached out. Then she saw his maimed left hand. She made a disgusted sound and flinched back. An angry curse came to Ralph's lips, but he suppressed it. With some difficulty, he forced himself to speak in a light tone of voice. "Don't be afraid of my wounded hand," he said. "You should be proud of it. I lost those fingers in the service of the king." He kept both arms stretched out expectantly. With an effort, she took his hands. "Now you can kiss me, Tilly." He was seated, and she was standing in front of him. She leaned forward and offered her cheek. He put his wounded hand at the back of her head and turned her face. Then he kissed her lips. He sensed her uncertainty and guessed that she had not been kissed by a man before. He let his mouth linger on hers, partly because it was so sweet, and partly to enrage those watching. Then, with slow deliberation, he pressed his good hand against her chest and felt her breasts. They were full and round. She was no child. He released her and sighed with satisfaction. "We must get married soon," he said. He turned to Caris, who was visibly suppressing anger. "In Kingsbridge Cathedral, 4 weeks from Sunday," he said. He looked at Philippa, but addressed William. "As we're getting married by the express wish of His Majesty King Edward, I would be honoured if you would attend, Earl William." William nodded curtly. Caris spoke for the first time. "Sir Ralph, the Prior of Kingsbridge sends you greetings, and says he will be honoured to perform the ceremony, unless, of course, the new bishop wishes to do so." Ralph nodded graciously. She then added, "But those of us who have had charge of this child believe she is still too young to live with her husband conjugally." Philippa said, "I concur." Ralph's father spoke,
"You know, son, I waited years to marry your mother."
Ralph did not want to hear that story all over again. "Unlike you, father, I have been ordered by the king to marry Lady Matilda." His mother said, "Perhaps you should wait, son." "I have waited more than a year. She was 12 when the king gave her to me." Caris said, "Marry the child, yes, with all due ceremony, but then let her return to the nunnery for a year. Let her grow fully into her womanhood. Then bring her to your home." Ralph snorted scornfully. "I could be dead in a year, especially if the king decides to go back to France. Meanwhile, the Fitzgeralds need an heir." "She is a child," Ralph interrupted, raising his voice.
"She is no child. Look at her. That stupid nun's habit can't disguise her breasts.
Puppy fat.
Does she have a woman's hair?"
Ralph demanded. Tilly gasped at his crude frankness, and her cheeks reddened with shame. Caris hesitated. Ralph said, "Perhaps my mother should examine her on my behalf and tell me." Caris shook her head. "That won't be necessary. Tilly has hair, where a woman has it, and a child does not."
"I knew as much. I have seen..."
Ralph stopped, realizing that he did not want everyone here to know in what circumstances he had seen the naked bodies of girls of Tilly's age. "I guessed from her figure," he amended, avoiding his mother's eye. A rarely heard pleading tone entered Caris's voice. "But, Ralph, in her mind she is still a child."
"I don't care about her mind," Ralph thought, but he did not say so.
"She has 4 weeks to learn what she does not know," he said. He gave Caris a knowing look.
"I'm sure you can teach her everything."
Caris flushed. Nuns were not supposed to know about marital intimacy, of course, but she had been his brother's girlfriend. His mother said,
"Perhaps a compromise. You just don't understand, mother, do you?"
he said, rudely interrupting her.
"No one is really concerned about her age. If I were going to marry the daughter of a Kingsbridge butcher, they wouldn't care if she was 9. It's because Tilly is noble-born. Don't you see that? They think they're superior to us."
He knew he was shouting, and he could see the amazed expressions of everyone around him. But he did not care.
"They don't want a cousin of the Earl of Shiring to marry the son of an impoverished knight. They want to put off the marriage, in the hope that I'll be killed in battle before it's consummated."
He wiped his mouth.
"But this son of an impoverished knight fought at the Battle of Crecy and saved the life of the Prince of Wales. That's what matters to the king."
He looked at each of them in turn. Haughty William, scornful Philippa, furious Caris, and his astonished parents.
"So you might as well accept the facts.
Ralph Fitzgerald is a knight and a lord, and a comrade in arms of the king, and he's going to marry Lady Matilda, the cousin of the Earl, whether you like it or not." There was a shocked silence for several moments. At last Ralph turned to Daniel. "You can serve dinner now," he said.
Chapter 53. In the spring of 1348, Merthyn woke up as if from a nightmare he could not quite remember. He felt frightened and weak. He opened his eyes to a room lit by bars of bright sunshine coming through half-open shutters. He saw a high ceiling, white walls, red tiles. The air was mild. Reality returned slowly. He was in his bedroom, in his house, in Florence. He had been ill. The illness came back to him first. It had begun with a skin rash, purplish-black blotches on his chest, then his arms, then everywhere. Soon afterwards he developed a painful lump or bubo in his armpit. He had a fever, sweating in his bed, tangling the sheets as he writhed. He had vomited and coughed blood. He had thought he would die. Worst of all was a terrible, unquenchable thirst that had made him want to throw himself into the River Arno with his mouth open. He was not the only sufferer. Thousands of Italians had fallen ill with this plague, tens of thousands. Half the workmen on his building sites had disappeared, as had most of his household servants. Almost everyone who caught it died within 5 days. They called it La Moria Grande, the Big Death. But he was alive. He had a nagging feeling that, while ill, he had reached a momentous decision, but he could not remember it. He concentrated for a moment. The harder he thought, the more elusive the memory became, until it vanished. He sat up in bed. His limbs felt feeble and his head spun for a moment. He was wearing a clean linen nightshirt, and he wondered who had put it on him. After a pause, he stood. He had a 4-story house with a courtyard. He had designed and built it himself, with a flat facade instead of the traditional overhanging floors, and architectural features such as round window arches and classical columns. The neighbors had called it a palaghetto, a mini palace. That was 7 years ago. Several prosperous Florentine merchants had asked him to build palaghetti for them, and that had got his career here started. Florence was a republic, with no ruling prince or duke, dominated by an elite of squabbling merchant families. The city was populated by thousands of weavers, but it was the merchants who made fortunes. They spent their money building grand houses, which made the city a perfect place for a talented young architect to prosper. He went to the bedroom door and called his wife. "Sylvia, where are you?" It came naturally to him to speak Italian now, after 9 years, and he suspected he even had a Tuscan accent. Then he remembered. Sylvia had been ill too. So had their daughter, who was 3 years old. Her name was Laura, but they had adopted her childish pronunciation, Lola. His heart was gripped by a terrible fear. Was Sylvia alive? Was Lola? The house was quiet. So was the city, he realized suddenly. The angle of the sunlight slanting into the rooms told him it was mid-morning. He should have been hearing the cries of street hawkers, the clop of horses and the rumble of wooden cartwheels, the background murmur of 1,000 conversations, but there was nothing. He went up the stairs. In his weakness, the effort made him breathless. He pushed open the door to the nursery. The room looked empty. He broke out in a sweat of fear. There was Lola's cot, a small chest for her clothes, a box of toys, a miniature table with 2 tiny chairs. Then he heard a noise. There in the corner was Lola, sitting on the floor in a clean dress, playing with a small wooden horse with articulated legs. Merthyn gave a strangled cry of relief. She heard him and looked up. "Papa," she observed in a matter-of-fact tone. Merthyn picked her up and hugged her. "You're alive," he said in English. There was a sound from the next room, and Maria walked in. A grey-haired woman in her 50s, she was Lola's nurse.
"Master," she said, "you got up. Are you better?"
"Where is your mistress?" he said. Maria's face fell.
"I'm so sorry, master," she said. "The mistress died."
Lola said,
"Mama's gone."
Merthin felt the shock like a blow. Stunned, he handed Lola to Maria. Moving slowly and carefully, he turned away and walked out of the room, then down the stairs to the piano nobile, the principal floor. He stared at the long table, the empty chairs, the rugs on the floor and the pictures on the walls. It looked like someone else's home. He stood in front of a painting of the Virgin Mary with her mother. Italian painters were superior to the English or any others, and this artist had given St. Anne the face of Sylvia. She was a proud beauty with flawless olive skin and noble features, but the painter had seen the sexual passion smouldering in those aloof brown eyes. It was hard to comprehend that Sylvia no longer existed. He thought of her slim body, and remembered how he had marveled again and again at her perfect breasts. That body, with which he had been so completely intimate, now lay in the ground somewhere. When he imagined that, tears came to his eyes at last, and he sobbed with grief. Where was her grave? He wondered in his misery. He remembered that funerals had ceased in Florence. People were terrified to leave their houses. They simply dragged the bodies outside and laid them on the street. The city's thieves, beggars, and drunks had acquired a new profession. They were called corpse carriers, or becchini, and they charged exorbitant fees to take the bodies away and put them in mass graves. Merthin might never know where Sylvia lay. They had been married 4 years. Looking at her picture, garbed in St. Anne's conventional red dress, Merthin suffered an access of painful honesty and asked himself whether he had really loved her. He was very fond of her, but it was not an all-consuming passion. She had an independent spirit and a sharp tongue, and he was the only man in Florence with the nerve to woo her, despite her father's wealth. In return, she had given him complete devotion, but she had accurately gauged the quality of his love. "What are you thinking about?" she used to say sometimes, and he would give a guilty start, because he had been remembering Kingsbridge. Soon she changed it to, "Who are you thinking about?" He never spoke Caris's name, but Sylvia said, "It must be a woman. I can tell by the look on your face." Eventually she began to talk about your English girl. She would say, "You're remembering your English girl." And she was always right. But she seemed to accept it. Merthin was faithful to her, and he adored Lola. After a while, Maria brought him soup and bread. "What day is it?" he asked her.
"A Tuesday."
"How long was I in bed?"
2 weeks. You were so ill."
He wondered why he had survived. Some people never succumbed to the disease, as if they had natural protection. But those who caught it nearly always died. However, the tiny minority who recovered were doubly fortunate, for no one had ever caught the illness a second time. When he had eaten, he felt stronger. He had to rebuild his life, he realized. He suspected that he had already made this decision once, when he was ill, but again he was tantalized by the thread of a memory slipping from his grasp. His first task was to find out how much of his family was left. He took his dishes to the kitchen, where Maria was feeding Lola bread dipped in goat's milk. He asked her, "What about Sylvia's parents? Are they alive?"
"I don't know," she said. "I haven't heard. I go out only to buy food."
"I'd better find out." He got dressed and went downstairs. The ground floor of the house was a workshop, with the yard at the rear used for storing wood and stone. No one was at work, either inside or out. He left the house. The buildings around him were mostly stone-built, some of them very grand. Kingsbridge had no houses to compare with these. The richest man in Kingsbridge, Edmund Wooler, had lived in a timber house. Here in Florence, only the poor lived in such places. The street was deserted. He had never seen it this way, not even in the middle of the night. The effect was eerie.